lovely reminder in that Metta Sutta, a way to sort of move us out of the center of our lives that we run around in and connect with all of the other beings in this world, also running around the world thinking they're the center of the world. Just an opportunity to remember our interconnectedness. And this afternoon, as I was having a cup of tea with my partner, he said to me, "So what are you planning on talking about tonight?" Fortunately, Marlene had sent me an email yesterday to remind me that I was talking tonight, which was most appreciated because I knew, but I'd forgotten. Anyway, I said, I think I'm going to talk about the benefits of having unwanted thoughts and feelings show up in our meditation. Usually when we have unwanted thoughts and feelings, we just want to get rid of them. They cause us discomfort. We don't like them. Sometimes we don't like ourselves because we have them. And it's a reasonably common habit of simply strengthening aversion by judging those thoughts and feelings and resisting them. And in a nutshell, by appreciating unwanted thoughts and feelings that show up in meditation, we can then learn about so much about being a human being, having a human mind, having a human heart. We can learn about the conditioned nature of the mind. We can see the dukkha, the suffering that happens when we take things personally, our unwanted mental and emotional states when we hold on to them and see them as being who we are. It also gives us an opportunity to cultivate kindness and balance or equanimity. It gives us an opportunity to train the heart mind to respond to whatever's unwanted with kindness, so that when other unwanted things show up in the rest of our lives, we're able to meet it more skillfully. But I am jumping ahead a little bit. I don't know if any of you read The Guardian, but there was a great article in The Guardian newspaper that was an article on Robina Korten, who's a Tibetan, Australian Tibetan nun. And she's actually taught in Perth a few times. And I've been to her teachings. She takes no prisoners. She's pretty scary. But she's great as well. But one of the things that I liked what she said is, she said, people don't expect to become a good musician because of external forces. We know it takes intention, it takes time, it takes practice, it takes patience and effort. We know we need to direct that process. And yes, a good teacher's important and good musical companions help. It needs to be driven and directed by the individual in order to meet that potential. We know that about becoming a musician, and yet we can have a belief that our inner peace, our inner happiness is somehow the outcome of external forces, and that there isn't much we can do about it. The Buddha clearly thought that our happiness and our peace of mind was very much our business, and that we can create an inner state of stability, balance, kindness, understanding, clarity, all those things that support well-being as director of this human experience that we're in. And as with a musician, good teachers and good companions certainly help. We still need to be the director of that process. Excuse me. And so tonight we're here to reflect and practice together, knowing that we need to bring our own intention, direction, some gentle and persistent endeavor to this process, and not rely on external forces to do the work for us. I've got a little poem I'd love to share. with us all. And Helen, who was mentioned in Chris's introduction, Helen and I write curriculum, mindfulness-based social and emotional curriculum for schools. And she has kindly agreed to read this poem for us. And I'll move it down when you get towards there, Helen. It keeps on going. So if you could unmute.
The precise moment of choice. My heart knows what is important. When I slow down and listen, it kindly reminds me of the simple truth. Each small habit I have makes up the total of how I live. Not the job I do, the house where I live, who I love, or what I say, but the choices I make each minute that sculpt my life. A better life doesn't come from wishing or wanting, complaining or resenting, nor from therapy or pushing or trying harder, but from the still moments between a thought and its action, the precise moment when I can choose. To notice those spaces between impulse and action, between thought and deed, is to choose consciously how I want to live. Not the habitual life I have settled for, or the conditioned life I have inherited, or the hurried life I have manufactured, not even the fantasy life I have imagined, but the mindful life. I choose in the precious moments when I breathe out, before I breathe in, but knows what I really want without guilt or shame, shoulds or have-tos. Those precious moments that lead me back to my heart, that knows what is indeed important and create for me the life I desire.
Thanks, Helen. And Jane, the poet's focus on every moment as being important, not necessarily the grand things in our lives, but what's happening now and between now and then the next moment, the encouragement to stay mindful and present to it all. And so coming back to the focus that I thought I'd talk about tonight of unwanted mind states, they are another thing that we can bring attention to. And the encouragement is to, rather than to try and avoid uncomfortable mind states, turn towards them. There's so much to learn. And meditation is about learning. It's about learning how the heart, the mind, the body all interact. It's about learning how to be in this human existence. It's about training the heart and mind. And to be able to train this heart and mind, it's important to know the way it works. And it's messy. It's messy in here. I don't know about your heart. Yes, your heart, mind. Actually, I've got a pretty good sense. It's messy at times too, just like mine. If you've spent more than 10 minutes observing the heart, mind, your own heart, mind, you know that. So when challenging mind states arise, it can be really useful to investigate. Not just simply when we're meditating to turn back to the meditation anchor. So that might also be an option depending on how we're choosing to meditate. But I want to put some emphasis on the value of investigating and looking at these unwanted states that do arise. And investigation is the second of the seven factors of awakening. It's a recognized important part of practice. Before we can start to play beautiful music in this mind and heart, we need to become experts in how the mind heart operates in different conditions. We need to understand our own patterns, beliefs, and there are many things that we have that are in common with or with other humans. You know, we're all hardwired to pursue rewards, to run after what we want. And we're all hardwired to react strongly when we feel under threat. Each of us, due to our particular conditioning, will have some differences in the particulars of the things that we chase, the rewards that we want, food, sex, status, admiration, those kinds of things. And we might feel threatened in different situations as well. But the basics of running after rewards and reacting to threats is something that all human beings experience. And meditation is the perfect place to learn about this mind. In meditation, awareness, that capacity of the mind that's vital for learning, can observe the thoughts, judgments, feelings, patterns, urges, memories, reactions. And depending on the attitude that we bring to meditation, we can support learning or we can shut down from learning. If we come to meditation with a judging mind, we'll have plenty of material that we can judge ourselves on, things that we don't want, things that are not admirable, things that are not skillful. And if we simply practice more judging when we see those thoughts and reactions, that's pretty painful. And we generate an additional layer of pain through that self-criticism. So the attitude that we bring to the investigation is really important, because we are certainly likely to see self-centered thoughts. I was thinking of some examples of some of the different thoughts. And when I was thinking of self-centered thoughts, I was thinking when I went to on retreat recently up to Jhana Grove, I hope there's nobody else in my cottage. It's all about me and my experience. And I kept on saying, Catherine, having an experience that you don't want is really useful. It's really useful because then you get the experience of meeting that. But there was this little part of me that was saying, yes, 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 I know that. And I really hope I get the cottage to myself. Met that one. Judgmental thoughts, scared thoughts, obsessive thoughts, vain thoughts. Thinking of vain thoughts, you know, again, another example from my recent retreat. Gee, I hope they notice what a serene person I am. The mind can do anything. Anyway, if we bring a self-critical attitude with awareness, it's very painful, as I mentioned, because we get to see this messy mind and we just shoot another arrow at ourselves. Self-criticism is just an example of aversion. And we know that aversion, one of the three key poisons, is an obstacle to a peaceful and happy mind. How can we transform criticism, self-criticism, into a more understanding and caring process? Certainly, in my experience, it takes time, but it is one of the most useful things that I've learned about studying this experience of being a human being. The slow transformation of moving from a strong inner critic and self-judgment to more acceptance, understanding, kindness. And the time on retreat has been really useful for that. And there's still lots of room to continue this transformation. I'm certainly not sitting here a fully transformed human being. But that recent retreat I did up at Jhana Grove was quite heartening for me, actually. It was lovely to see the slow but real benefits that have happened over the years by bringing attention to the content of the mind and strengthening my capacity to attend to the content of the mind from a place of caring and understanding and lightness, at least sometimes. There were times during the retreat that were beautiful, still, peaceful, tranquil. And when it was like that for me, I'd delight in it. Who doesn't? And then there were many times when the mind was not still, peaceful, or tranquil. Over the 18 days I was there, I had the opportunity to sit with a huge variety of mind states. And the task, as I saw it, was to observe what was unfolding with curiosity and care, and do my best not to add another layer of reactivity or judgment. And as I mentioned, I really valued the opportunity to work with more challenging mind states on retreat. And I think whether it's on retreat or just in any meditation, it's very valuable because we get to see those mind states in a more intentional way when we're meditating. Meditation is a laboratory of the mind heart. We're not having to cook dinner or drive a car or do something else. We can bring all of our attention to the process of better understanding what's going on, investigating it, seeing if there's another way of responding. And we don't transform the mind without meeting unpleasant states of mind. So I think it's very helpful not to see uncomfortable mind states such as greed, such as fear, such as hurt, such as sadness, such as shame, anger, judgment, not to see them as bad when they arise, but rather see them as a really important opportunity. They give us the opportunity time and again to see if we can meet them with curiosity, interest, care, and through how we meet them, strengthen our capacity for balance, for equanimity, and at the same time decrease our attachment and identification, our attachment to self. You probably know, your top five mind patterns. One of the ones that I got to see on retreat that I'm very familiar with is, and it's a recurring habitual pattern, is planning. And sometimes that planning can get a bit obsessive. And while I was on the retreat, and this is a month ago now, amongst the planning I did was planning for tonight, what I was going to say. Of course, I'm saying nothing like what I planned a month ago. And that's one of the things about planning. Often it's a waste of time. But this mind was at times really caught up in planning different things, a variety of different things, sometimes quite obsessively. So rather than criticize the mind when it was doing that, when I could, I'd investigate. When I remembered, I'd investigate. In order to more fully know that experience, how does it feel in the body when I'm in this obsessive planning? There's tightness, there's contraction, there's a closeness in the body. How's it in the mind? It's quite, some of the words would be similar. There's a narrowing, it's very unfree. I'm not having much choice about what's going on in the mind. It's caught. There's a bit of dukkha there, a bit of suffering in this experience. And I'd ask, you know, why all this planning? What are the causes and conditions that have brought this about? Is the mind unhappy to be meditating? I don't think so. I'm happy enough. Well, maybe there is a little bit of a lack of excitement. What else is here? Is there any fear behind this? Fear of stuffing up? Fear of forgetting something? Fear of letting somebody down, falling short? There might be a bit of fear here. Is it wanting to be seen as competent? Absolutely. Add to that a little bit of fear that, that underlying fear that so many of us know, oh, I'm not good enough. A need to be accepted. And also there's something for me quite enjoyable about the activity of planning. I find it stimulating. And that maybe go back to the relative lack of stimulation when one is just sitting quietly, observing the breath. All of these were underlying drivers to the experiences of more obsessive thinking and planning. And so through that investigation, I was able to become more aware of some very natural human concerns and wants that I was experiencing. Nothing very specific to Catherine, although Catherine has her own version of them. And so seeing those fears and needs as part of the human condition means that I don't need to, as I would have very quickly in the past, see them as a personal flaw. I'm somehow, there's something bad or wrong about me because this mind is doing this. In the past, I would have been much quicker to judge myself as needy, of lacking self-sufficiency. It feels such a beautiful thing to not have that immediate additional layer of identification with the mind states, but just see it as something that's arisen in this situation for all these particular reasons. When we identify with a particular mind state as a personal flaw, it's much more difficult to approach it, to sit with it, to soften towards it, and understand that it's just a human mind doing its stuff. By seeing it as, maybe from a bigger perspective, part of the human condition, it makes it much easier to bring some care to it and then soften, let go of the planning, come back into awareness, rinse and repeat. Because planning for me is such a strong habit. You don't do this once and it's done. I had lots of opportunities to practice planning all sorts of things. Observing it, investigating it, understanding it, softening, letting go, resting in awareness, that process. And through that process, through that investigation, um, seeing more clearly the dukkha that's involved in a tight craving mind, seeing the dukkha, that suffering that's involved in identifying with particular mind states, seeing impermanence, seeing how fluid mind states are, how they come and go, they change depending on changing causes and conditions, and also see the power of anatta or non-self, not taking things personally. All of those elements support the practice of being able to see clearly, let it go, come back into awareness, or stay in awareness, but without that same caught mind. We'll be probably, I just want to say a few more things before we start our practice, but not too much. You might have guessed that from my focus on welcoming or encouragement to welcome unwanted or difficult or challenging mind states, the approach that I'll be offering, inviting us into tonight's meditation, is one which supports us in developing insight, developing wisdom. I think, Gita, when you were teaching us a few weeks ago, we listened to part of an Ajahn Chah talk where he talked both about Samatha practice and Vipassana practice. So if you remember back to that, what I'm talking about here is more in the Vipassana practice orientation. And Samatha, where our objective in meditation is calm, tranquility, calm abiding, it's a very important part of practice. And it's not always available to us. So when calm, peaceful, tranquil, abiding isn't what we're experiencing, it can be really useful to have an alternative practice that values whatever it is that's coming up in the mind. And so the invitation tonight is to experiment if your practice is if your preference is for a samatha practice, please feel free to do that practice if that's comfortable for you. And if you would like to have an orientation of, let's explore this mind. Can I bring curiosity to what will arise in my mind? Can I bring interest and care, non-reactivity? What might I learn? What might I develop? What might I strengthen through that orientation? Both practices are useful. So what might be the most appropriate practice for this mind tonight? And if we are bringing more of an insight or Vipassana orientation, certainly what we are also developing in addition to wisdom is kindness, non-reactivity, equanimity, balance, ability to meet whatever it is that arises in our experience. Very valuable. So in tonight's practice, I'm going to invite you to have an anchor, a broad anchor of the whole body, if that feels okay. The whole body sitting and resting, just putting down my chair to feel more comfortable in that position. And from that place, that whole body awareness, we can observe the comings and goings of thoughts, feelings, urges, judgments, without seeing them as a problem. So as you, I can see everybody's getting themselves ready, which is lovely, making the body know that it's been attended to. So if you need to make any adjustments or have a little stretch, feel free. Having a sense of the body resting in the chair. Maybe just experiment. See what happens if you bring one hand onto your belly and one hand onto the center of your chest. Through that contact of the hands on the belly and the chest, it connects us very directly to the breath. And if you keep the hands there for a little while, maybe you can feel the warmth of the touch. And the warmth of that physical touch can support a warmth in attitude, a warmth in orientation, a caring for this person in this moment, this mind, heart, body complex. Inviting that caring orientation with curiosity of what might arise. And feel free to either leave the hands there if they were on your belly and your chest, or bring them into a different place that is also comfortable. As you feel this whole body resting, there may be a sense that there's something that can be done to support the body relax a little further. Maybe softening the muscles of the face. The muscles around the eyes. The shoulders and arms. The chest, belly. Hips and legs. And as the body softens, inviting the mind to do the same. Nothing to do. Nowhere to go. Resting in this breathing body. And I'll be quiet for some time now as you observe the movement of the mind, the coming and going, the thoughts, the feelings, the urges. None of them a problem until we make them a problem. How can we meet what may arise in this mind, heart, in this moment? Giving it your best shot and letting that be good enough. And if you find that at times you get caught up and you actually lose awareness of this present moment and the unfolding experience, the changes flowing through the mind and the heart, you get caught up in a story or some experience. Bhikkhu Anālayo suggests smiling so that we're practicing meeting, getting lost without aversion, smiling and coming back once again to this whole body, resting, sitting, coming back into the awareness of the changing inner experience. In this practice, we see that thoughts aren't necessarily an obstacle to meditation. We can meditate and be aware of the changing nature of thoughts, their coming and going, the silences in between, the contractions, the expansions, resting in the awareness that witnesses those changes, comings and goings. As you rest in awareness, what is it that you're aware of? Perhaps body sensations. Thoughts. Dullness. Some feeling. What do you know in this moment? We're coming towards the end of the practice now. You may hear in the background some bangs. I'm very close to the Royal Showgrounds and the fireworks are happening now, so all is safe. A lovely Alyssa, how nice our meditation ends with fireworks.
Yeah.
There's still a few to come, I think. I've been having it. I turned my mic off. I didn't think everybody needed to hear all the fireworks. Yes.
Well, that definitely brings us to a point. What would you like to do, Catherine? Continue with your talk, or would you like to do questions and answers?
Yeah, very happy to do that. And there's a couple of people who asked for a copy of the poem. So I'm just going to see if I can actually put it into the chat. It's quite long, but let's see how it goes. I can't. It doesn't know Control V. Maybe. There we go. Maybe. No.
I can send it on, Catherine, if you send it to me.
Will do, Marlene. Thank you. There probably is some way I can do it, but beyond me. And speaking of the Royal Show, I wanted to show this picture. So if you don't know the Royal Show, if you're not a West Australian, the Royal Show, the Royal Agricultural Show, is a fair that has, you know, all sorts of exhibits, from guinea pigs to bulls to wood chops to sideshows to roller coasters, that kind of thing. And it's all happening just across the road. But this particular picture grabbed me because sometimes we can feel like our cravings, our aversion, the nose ring, and we are being pulled about from place to place by those aversions and cravings and that kind of thing. And one of the things I think we learn through meditation is that we don't, and through studying the Dharma, is that we don't achieve a peaceful, happy mind through satisfying our cravings, but rather we achieve a peaceful, happy mind by taking the nose ring out, if that makes sense, if that analogy makes sense. Anyway, just a little Royal Show connection. So yeah, very happy to hear what people thought. Reflections, comments, questions, any of that. Alyssa.
Hi, so Catherine, thank you so much. And so much fun to have fireworks at the end there and continue.
Put on for the group.
Thank you. And well, first of all, reading what Marlene sent out, your experience, and it's just so wonderful to read and all of your experience, really just far and wide, and it's really nice. It's really nice. I really value your being here and your teaching. And with the nose ring, it did remind me of something I heard a lay teacher from a Buddhist fellowship in Singapore say, Dr. Ung, and she said, your volitions will ride you like a horse. And so it reminded me of with the nose ring. But my question to you, they'll take you. Labeling as a way to calm the mind. And I was wondering if you could just, talk about that a bit, about the labeling and maybe some ways to go about it.
Yeah. So labeling, for people who aren't familiar with that term, is as we sit in meditation or even outside of formal meditation, and we notice something arising in the mind, whether it's thinking or whether we want to get even more precise and label it planning or catastrophizing or judging. So it's as we observe what comes into the mind, dropping silently in the mind a label. And in doing that, we support ourselves to take a little bit of a step back from what is usually happening when those kinds of things arise in the mind, which is that we fuse with them and we lose awareness. So usually when judgment arises, we get caught in judgment and we're in the story, we're in the drama of it. Naming judging gives us the opportunity to stand back, observe it, and that gives us more chance of it continuing on its way rather than us continuing to be fused with it. Now, labeling is a very widely used and well-known practice, something that I've used from time to time. It certainly supports the moving, stepping back from being caught in whatever the mind is generating. And sometimes it can be incredibly skillful, and sometimes we don't need it. So we can just simply observe anything coming and going. So I think it depends on how sticky the mind is. And similarly with the investigation that I was talking about prior to the meditation, for a relatively light mind state, we might simply be able to sit in awareness, observe it come, observe it go. If it's stickier, and by stickier I mean it catches our attention, catches our awareness, and we lose some of that present moment awareness, a label can be very useful. Similarly, if it's even more sticky, the investigation can be very useful. So it's I don't think a one answer for any particular mind state, but it's a very useful thing to have in our tool bag. Is there anything else that you were thinking of with that, Alyssa?
I wrote down so many notes, but I just... you did mention, because as the Buddha said, peace of mind is our own business. It's our own business. And there's a lot of repetition in the mind. And it reminded something Ajahn Brahmali said. He said, Buddhism is learning the same things over and over and over again, right? And so the same things will come up. And so we generate this interest. We have to generate the interest in the same things. And you touched on so much of that. And the patience. See, the fireworks are coming. My head is like, all the thoughts are coming. So there's a lot. There's a lot. And I think just I need some time to just absorb. And so I think that's it for the moment. Thank you. Thank you so much.
And thanks for that reminder from Ajahn Brahmali as well. I mean, I think sitting with our mind can be such a humbling experience, particularly, how many times do we have to hear some of these teachings? Sometimes I can hear something and it feels like I've heard it for the 400th time, but I'm hearing it for the first time. The conditions, what I understand by that is that the conditions have changed so that my mind is now able to understand it in a different way. So there's sort of layers and depths, and I just forget. We just forget as well. Yeah, thanks, Alyssa. Tony.
Yes, thank you. I'm a bit gobsmacked that you've actually, this is the topic that you've spoken about this evening, because this is something that I've been looking into quite considerably lately, and I've struggled with understanding how one does meditation, reflection, contemplation, when nearly everything that I'm reading or hearing is saying that we need to let go, calm the mind. If we are to do contemplation, then it's to be around 32 parts, you know, contemplation of death, contemplation of impermanence. But I guess I'm asking for clarification. Is everything that you've explained this evening, I can't think of a better word, but allowing us to allow a thought to come up and to just see where that thought goes, and rather than driving the thought to investigate it, is it just almost observing where the thought goes? Is that, am I making sense?
Yeah, I think so, Tony, and you'll correct me if my response isn't useful. There are many ways that we can meet different mind states that come up in our meditation. Now, if our practice, if we've sat down to practice with an intention of having a samatha practice, which is about calm abiding, tranquility, single focus, what we'll do is when things come up, we'll let them go, we'll come on back. We'll let them go, we'll come on back. We'll let them go gently, kindly, we'll let them go, we'll come on back. Because we're strengthening that focus and capacity to stabilize attention on one thing. And that's a very important practice, and it's a very useful practice, and it's not the only practice. It's one of the ways that we can meditate. And even in the Anapanasati Sutta, 16 Steps of Mindfulness. In that sutta, the Buddha talks about in the meditation, as we breathe in and as we breathe out, observing mind states. And that includes thoughts and feelings, and because mind states includes heart as well. So observing all of these things. So he doesn't say get rid of them, observing them as you breathe in and out. So it's and as we do that in the Anapanasati Sutta, it says that then you'll observe that over time they will subside, they'll tranquilize. But there's no efforting in getting rid of them, in doing anything with them. So that's one of the forms of meditating with thoughts and feelings. We're with them. The challenge with meditating with thoughts and feelings is that fact that we fuse with them. The more that we cultivate awareness of experience, and particularly awareness of thoughts, it enables us to experience thoughts in the same way we experience other phenomena that are part of the present moment, whether it's an itch on the leg or a sound or something else. I'm sitting stable in my awareness, observing this experience. Thoughts are really tricky. We've got to practice and practice and practice and practice to be able to stay in the awareness rather than in the getting fused with them and getting taken away from awareness. The more detailed investigation of a mind state that I mentioned, that I spoke about before the meditation, is a helpful thing when that mind state is quite obsessive, is quite repetitive, and we need to understand it better in order to be able to let it flow through. It keeps on coming and grabbing us. And so we need to understand it better in order to get some freedom from it. So we wouldn't want to be doing that with everything.
Sure. Okay. So if I can use an analogy, it's not as if we're contemplating the philosophy of something. It's we're just allowing it
That is another form of meditation where you can contemplate philosophies, but what I was inviting us into wasn't that. But that is another form of meditation.
Is that Buddhist? Is that?
Yep. There is Buddhist meditation which contemplates elements of the philosophy. Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you,
Catherine. It's tricky, isn't it? There's so many forms, and we think we've got it, and then, there's another way of doing it. Am I doing it wrong?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I raised the question was there's things in life that we don't understand, and experiences, and I guess there's some others, if not everyone, searches for what that means, and so I was just interested in contemplative meditation as to something, whether it's a rose, but at the same time not wanting to preoccupy the mind.
Depends what you mean by preoccupy the mind, because contemplating something really wholesome can enliven and lighten and brighten the mind. Anyway, I might move on to Martha. And thank you very much, Tony.
Okay, thank you so much, because I've got an appointment at 8:30 right next door. This is so helpful. First of all, thank you for that thought about, just the way you put not putting judgments on something that's already there, super painful anyway. And also the specific information about planning. I'm a planner and the mind's always there. It's, thank you for saying it's a waste of time. It's a waste of time.
A little bit of planning might be okay, but when we're doing it for the 500th time, it's like, really?
It's awful. You know, I do think I have that fear of the fear of forgetting something, because I did have a breakdown and forgot a whole bunch of stuff. Mm. But that was helpful, what both everybody's just said. But how do you spell samadhi? The samatha meditation?
Samatha. S-A-M-A-T-H-A.
Samatha. Okay. All right. So that's the first thing. And then the other thing that was very helpful to just hear talking about not fusing with the thoughts and getting all hardened in them. I had a hard time during this meditation going from breath to whole body. Is it possible to explain how you go from how you do the whole body as an anchor?
If we're familiar with any particular anchor, and we've been using a particular anchor for a period of time, we build up a habit energy around that. So when we sit down to meditate, if the breath has been our anchor, the mind can say, yeah, I know what I'm doing, and go to the breath. And so that's not a problem. That's what will happen. And so you might, if you wanted to explore having a broader anchor, the whole body, you might bring your attention to where you feel the breath in the body. It might be your belly, it might be your tip of your nose, it might be your chest, wherever that is, And just little bit by little bit from that place, expanding. So if it's your belly, I'm doing it right now as I talk, just having a sense of bringing my attention into the belly and then slowly, slowly, slowly including more of the body until I can feel the feet on the floor, hands on my lap, my shoulders, the top of my head. Now, it is the case that when we have a narrow focus of attention, we see more detail in that thing. So when we have the whole body of in as our anchor, it's a bit more of a diffuse anchor, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does, and that's very helpful.
Catherine, we have a question in the chat. Would you like me to read it? Or
thank you.
Thank you very much for the guided meditation. Can I ask how to forgive yourself when other people don't forgive you?
Mm.
I can forgive other people easily, but I always struggle to forgive myself.
Thank you. Yeah, we can certainly find it very hard to offer understanding and compassion to ourselves and forgiveness. And there are different things that you might want to try. One of them is to, I'll name a couple perhaps. One of them is to think about the particular thing that needs forgiving in you. And imagine if it was a friend of yours, somebody that you care about, and that they had done that. So I'm going to give a very silly example, but say I forgot somebody's birthday and I'm beating myself up because I should be somebody who never forgets a birthday. I'm an unkind friend, blah, 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 blah. I'm getting cranky at myself because of that and I can't let go of that. How would I view that in somebody that I care about who forgot their friend's birthday? How would I see it in my friend that I know is a good person, that I know does the best, and I know, like everybody else, at times makes mistakes? How would I see it in my friend? What would I say to my friend? Even write that down. How would I respond to my friend if she did the thing that I think needs forgiving in me? What words might I use? Now, that might help because we're often able to say and understand and bring compassion and forgiveness to our friend. So what words would you use to your friend? And just practice saying them to yourself. Another way of doing it might be to think about you're not the person doing the forgiving, but some very wise, compassionate being is looking at you and the thing that needs forgiving. What might that wise, compassionate, if you're a Buddhist, you might think about the Buddha. How would the Buddha respond to that mistake or whatever it is, failure that needs forgiving? How would the Buddha understand it? How might the Buddha respond? Or if you're not a Buddhist, how might a wise and compassionate being respond to you in that situation? I can remember a few years ago now, I was on retreat up at Jhana Grove again, and Ajahn Brahm, I was asking him about letting go. Letting go is a real tricky one for me. And he said, imagine you're the Buddha. He said, we don't use imagination enough in Theravadan Buddhism. Imagination is used a lot in Tibetan Buddhism. We don't use it enough in Theravadan Buddhism, he said. Imagine you're the Buddha. Imagine if you had the Buddha mind, how would you respond to that? That's another way. Anyway, there are some things that came to mind just straight away. Geeta, did you want to add something?
Yes, Geeta's got an interesting comment as well in the chat, Geeta. Geeta,
you're muted,
you need
Geeta.
To unmute yourself. Can you unmute yourself, Geeta?
Yes. Well, Catherine, when you first started about unwanted thoughts and things that keep coming back and you're struggling with them, it reminded me of this quote from Ajahn Chah about these irritations that come. And when I first saw it, I got irritated with Ajahn Chah because, you know, if anything is irritating you, that is your teacher. And I'm thinking, you know, something was really irritating me at the time. And so I had to come, you know, stop and think, yeah, this is my teacher. You know, how I confront it, how I face it, how I sit with it. This is all teaching me.
Yeah.
That came to mind when you.
Yeah, thanks, Geeta. And certainly when we're irritated, it's not always the first thing we think of. But I think over time, when we engage in that practice of seeing it as a teacher, welcoming it, understanding that we're going to learn something really useful, understanding that this messiness is actually going to help us meet the next messiness with more skill, we can sort of narrow the time between irritation and being okay with it. And then it'll happen at some time and we'll be synchronized. Wouldn't that be lovely?
Yeah.
Thank you. I will send to Marlene the poem.